You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole translators of Steiner into English and have given me permission to make these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected work by Rudolf Steiner, number 181. Main title is Dying Earth and Living Cosmos. It's actually composed of three cycles of lectures. This is the third cycle of lectures I'm reading, and it is entitled, in the same book, The Need for New Forms of Consciousness. It is the third of seven lectures, numbered in the book as Lecture 17, given in Berlin on the 9th of July, 1918, translated by Matthew Barton. As we have seen from our recent reflections, life, the whole life of the human soul, is a complex matter. The human soul is connected by many different threads to many diverse fields, powers, and centers of the universe. I would first like, in only a few words, to recall something we broached 2 weeks ago as a point of departure for realities we will today begin to consider, and which may be able to illumine the world from a particular angle. I said that we can only acquaint ourselves with human reality by becoming fully aware of other states of consciousness besides our ordinary waking state, of dull twilight states of consciousness within this waking condition. Furthermore, I suggested that we can only fathom these states if we understand the threefold human being, the head, the trunk, and the extremities or limbs. Our whole being makes use of the head, certainly, to possess the kind of waking consciousness familiar to us. But, alongside this, as I said, the head possesses a dreamlike consciousness, which our waking awareness overrides. That enables us continually to gaze back into our former lives on Earth. And similarly, the limb system, though also connected to our whole being, continually develops a dreamlike awareness of our future life on Earth. The theory our spiritual science propounds of repeated lives on Earth is in fact, therefore, already a reality in the human soul. It is a reality of consciousness, albeit a dull, dim, twilight reality. Then we also described the dreamlike consciousness we develop through exhalation, which belongs to the trunk and rhythmic system, with its sense of our life between our last death and latest birth, and that developed by inhalation, similarly assigned to the rhythmic system, which gives us a dull, dim awareness of the life we will have from our next death through to a following birth. Briefly, then, these different states of consciousness interweave with each other in us. And all this can show you that our whole being is a finely woven organization, and that the way people usually view the human being represents only a very small and the least subtle portion of our whole human nature. This complexity is due to the fact that the diverse aspects of our whole being are embedded in worlds initially unavailable to ordinary perception, and can therefore be called supersensible as regards ordinary awareness. What in us is thus embedded in a world of spirit, even in the case of a none too subtle life of soul in very ordinary human existence, and can be traced through various earthly lives, is not at all simple or easy to understand. And yet we can only fathom the whole meaning of human life if we consider this highly complex human nature of ours as it passes through diverse lives on Earth. This finely woven fabric is actually, especially to modern perception, very concealed or masked. I will return to this idea of masking later. Really, we only know the human mask, for what descends from the world of spirit and as it were, sets up house here in the physical human being, and then rises again to worlds of spirit at death, does not announce itself in evident terms in human life. A great deal occurs in our palpable or easily visible life that conceals and masks processes leading us from one earthly life to another. We start to see how complex this life of ours is when we trace it over longer periods. And now, as I describe how our true life of soul passes through longer spans of time, I would beg you to entirely overlook the great difference between this description and the accounts of ordinary history. I have often said why this is so, and we will later come back to it and examine it in more detail. As I pointed out a little while ago, important developments in Occidental humanity took place in the 8th to the 7th century before the mystery of Golgotha. During this period, a significant transformation occurred in the people of the West. As we know, at that time, the third post-Atlantean epoch was followed by the fourth. Previously, prior to the 7th and 8th centuries BC, human souls largely possessed characteristics of the sentient soul, and now they acquired the character of the rational or mind soul. A further important point of transition occurred in the 15th century AD, and thus not that long ago, when the human soul acquired characteristics of the consciousness soul. The changing character of the soul we possess also alters the way in which we look back in dull, dreamlike awareness to a former incarnation. If we think of someone living, say, at the beginning of the Greco-Roman period, thus in the 4th or 3rd centuries BC, in the West, or a region close to it, we would find that generally he would possess a rational or mind-soul character. But the part of him that dreamed of former lives on earth would of course be focused on these former lives, where the soul had sentient-soul character. During the 4th post-Atlantean epoch, however, humankind gradually lost the ability to directly perceive recurring incarnations. Nevertheless, many did still possess this capacity. And those who did so and looked back to their former lives saw themselves as, if I can put it like this, the possessors of sentient souls. There was a relatively big difference between how people saw themselves at that time and what they perceived in a dreamlike vision of former lives. They saw a great divergence between their current and their past condition, between their rational or mind soul and the sentient soul they felt themselves to have possessed in a former incarnation. What is the significance of this sense of having been a sentient soul in your previous life? Today, scarcely anyone has this, and cannot have it. A real feeling of having been a sentient soul, of remembering this condition vividly, as people did in the first few centuries of the 4th post-Atlantean epoch. People in Egyptian and Chaldean culture in the 3rd post-Atlantean epoch felt themselves to be sentient souls. And this means that one has scarcely any sense of being a person who thinks. No importance is accorded to having thoughts. Instead, one continually has a vivid sense of being connected with one's surroundings, but these are at the same time imbued with spirit. It is really very difficult to describe this form of consciousness, this sense of being a sentient soul. It is a vivid experience that makes one continually feel one leaves part of oneself behind as shadow in all the places one passes through. If, say, you have been sitting on a chair and then you go for a walk, you would feel you are still sitting on the chair for a long time. There was a very vivid sense of connection with outward things. And above all, people continually had a very vivid, clear, and tangible sense of their spatial form before them. It was due to this great awareness of their spatial form that the doctrine of reincarnation, current at the time, was so vivid to them. You see, as people look back to past incarnations, growing aware in dreamlike perception of former lives on Earth, they saw a vivid image of their spatial human form. They really saw themselves, their form, in diverse situations. During the course of the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, this vivid perception gradually faded. In consequence, people were no longer able to draw upon sufficient strength to grasp the dreamlike recollections in them of their former lives. This was due particularly to the fact that as time went on, people were no longer recalling the vivid and immediate perceptions of the sentient soul. But increasingly, the rational or mind soul, with its less spatially immediate perceptions, a vaguer, less definite, and more inward quality, such a quality is harder to grasp. For this reason, people gradually ceased to have any memory of their former lives. During the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, however, this awareness of past incarnations will reappear in a very specific way. And no one can understand human evolution without understanding the truths we are now describing. What emerges in humanity appears in diverse ways in the most varied regions of our globe. I have often pointed out that we can expect a time to come in future, very specifically and significantly in the third millennium, when a certain capacity to look back to past lives, along with clear awareness of future lives, will become something possible for all. But this awareness will emerge in different ways in different regions, and it is extremely important to understand this. Let us for a moment consider various wider regions where this will emerge. First in the East, in Eastern Europe, and then extending into Asia, and thus the Orient. And then let us consider Western Europe and America in particular. This future capacity to grasp the reality of reincarnation is being prepared in different ways in these two wider regions. In the West, in initiate circles, this is already very well known. And it is significant that the West reckons with esoteric capacities and also envisages employing these in external life. To overlook this is to fail to understand Western developments and the whole influence of the West on humanity's history. The most important occurrences in the West, instigated by the Anglo-American race, are influenced by a more secret, intimate knowledge of evolving humanity. In describing what is involved in such matters, we soon, of course, risk speaking in paradox, since we are talking of things to which, in quotes, clever people will respond by saying, well, why aren't the initiates telling us about all this then? But you need only reflect on everything I have told you about Lucifer and Ahriman. What they do, feel, and especially what they have accomplished. And then along come people who think they are cleverer than Lucifer and Ahriman, and would not have done things as they have, such as staying retrograde in their development, and so on. But these things have to be properly understood. There are certain things one can do, precisely because one is, in a sense, cleverer than a human being. In the West, in particular, a tendency is emerging from certain secret underground sources to oppose reincarnation, to oppose recurring lives on Earth. In certain groups of deeply initiated people of the Anglo-American race, a battle is being waged against reincarnation itself. This is the paradox. Certain spiritual centers in the West are, in a sense, seeking to put an end to recurring lives on Earth, to the regularity of alternating lives, first between birth and death, and then between death and rebirth. The ultimate aim of this is to establish a quite different form of human life, and there are means by which this can be achieved. What they seek to do is the following. Through a certain kind of schooling, the endowing of particular powers, to place the human soul in a state where it feels ever more closely related to earthly powers and conditions after death, thereby developing a strong attraction toward these earthly powers, though, of course, to spiritual earthly powers. In consequence, the human soul will depart as little as possible from earthly regions after death, staying very close to these earthly regions, thus retaining a certain influence on them, and by so doing living on after death in connection with these regions. At the same time, in consequence, the soul after death will be relieved of the need, really, to enter a physical body again. This is a curious ideal to which the Anglo-American race aspires, no longer to return to earthly bodies, but for souls after death to exert an ever greater influence on the earth, to acquire ever more earthly souls. This ideal, therefore, involves making life here on earth and life after death more closely resemble each other. This will be achieved. For now, only among those who are schooled in this way, though such schooling will become ever more prevalent, let me read that again. This will be achieved, for now, only among those who are schooled in this way, though such schooling will become ever more prevalent, by awakening a much greater, stronger sense of the earth in human beings than otherwise normal. Without a certain Luciferic and Ahrimanic influence at work on the human being in Lemurian and Atlantean times, the human soul would now feel less closely related to the physical body than it does. Without this influence, numerous people who regard their body as belonging to the earth, the majority, would now sense this relationship to their body and the way they live in it as similar to our feeling of connection with the ground we walk on, and no more than that. Thanks to the Luciferic influence, we feel very closely associated with our body nowadays, but less so with the earth itself. We think of the earth as being outside us, but our body is part and parcel of us. Yet from a certain higher spiritual perspective, we are as much outside our body, even when awake, as we are distinct and separate from the earth. In a sense, our soul just steps upon our brain, which offers us the resistance we need to think. The Luciferic and Ahrimanic influence prevent us realizing this. Without this influence, as souls, we would feel much further removed from our body than we do, regarding it rather like a hill upon the earth, albeit a mobile one, like a sand dune, that supports us. Certain Anglo-American circles are making this into a pragmatic wisdom, developing feeling capacities of the human body to a great degree in a way that strengthens this sense of connection to the human body. They seek to augment this sense of connection by additional powers that are not only bodily ones, but bind the latter to the earth. By means of specific exercises, the people of this Anglo-American race are gradually meant to acquire the strong sense that their body belongs to the earth, is part of it. Besides feeling, quote, I am my arm or my leg, close quote, they should also feel that they are the force of gravity passing through their limbs, the weight pulling upon hands or arms. The aim, therefore, is to establish and develop a strong sense of physical affinity between the human body and earthly elements. The same kind of affinity exists strongly in certain species of ape today. They possess this affinity as their inner life, if you like, and one can study it as a phenomenon of physiology and zoology. What already exists here can be introduced gradually into a system for educating human beings, a form of bodily education and schooling that increasingly accentuates the human being's coarser affinity with nature. I am not denigrating this or being critical, but simply presenting facts to you. This results in a kind of pragmatic Darwinism, which endows people with a closer relationship or affinity to the earth, binding them more closely to it. In a sense, it is possible to make humankind more, in quotes, ape-like. This appears to be, in quotes, instinctive, but is being ably introduced and highly cultivated in particular forms of sport and similar domains. Thus the soul is coupled to the earth strongly through a feeling of physical affinity with it, bringing about the ideal I spoke of a moment ago, whereby the continual alternation between more spiritual life and more physical life is overcome. This ideal will lead eventually to souls living in future periods of Earth's evolution as a kind of ghost, dwelling upon Earth as a ghost of a sort. It is actually very interesting indeed to note that this ideal can primarily be cultivated only amongst the male population, and that this will therefore gradually lead, despite all external political measures, which often have the very opposite inward intent to their outward and apparent aim, to an increasing gulf between male and female. Anglo-American life of the mind, spirit, and culture will advance through women, will be passed on to posterity, whereas what lives in male bodies will tend toward the kind of ideals I described, also shaping the future bodily configuration of the Anglo-American race. If we now look eastward, we find a very different picture. Looking toward the east with keener perception is very appropriate for us today in Central Europe. What will develop and evolve there in Eastern Europe is at present entirely concealed, masked, suppressed, really. What has established itself at present in Eastern Europe is, of course, the very opposite of what must emerge there. In Greater Russia, as it is called, the battle waged against any cultural or spiritual life at the same time represents a battle against the very foundations of humanity's spiritual existence. The East is, in fact, where certain spiritual foundations of humanity must develop. And our era has little inclination to open its eyes and gain clear insight into what is happening. People sleepwalk through everything, despite the urgent need to form clear views about current events. Our contemporaries ought to form proper judgments about people such as Lenin and Trotsky, seeing them for what they are, the most aggressive enemies of humanity's true spiritual evolution, worse than the Roman Caesars, who are always described in damning terms, worse also than Machiavellian figures, such as the Borgias of the Renaissance, who in terms of their opposition to the spirit were mere infants compared to the likes of Lenin and Trotsky. People today simply overlook these realities, and it is necessary to point them out. There is one thing in particular to which people's attention should be drawn. The past 4 years ought to have shown everyone that the old legends of history should be radically revised. Compared to current events, we should realize that the Roman Caesars, or the events of the Renaissance, with the coloring history has given them, are old wives' tales, really. If you are happy with old wives' tales, then you will be sleepwalking through the lessons we can learn from the recent past. If, on the other hand, we want to discern what is in preparation in the East, we will have to wake up a little to things hidden from view below the surface. There is really a great deal more hidden there than used to be the case, although we can already find the beginnings of this in key figures in the history of Eastern Europe. A time will come, though it is still some way off, when people in Eastern Europe develop insight into reincarnation, though in a different way from what I described in relation to the West. In the West, we find a kind of battle waged against reincarnation. In the East there will be acceptance of it, assimilation of the truth of recurring lives on earth. Here human souls will long for an education that teaches them to perceive and experience not only what lives in them from birth to death, but from one life on earth to the next. Education will point to certain things that these people of Eastern Europe, in particular, will experience very powerfully. Children will be taught about something dwelling in the human being that they can feel and sense, that is more than their bodily life. Older people will teach younger ones to ask themselves what they feel within their soul. Through such questions posed in many different ways, they will come to sense that something exists in them that has entered their body but existed previously on earth, has passed through death, and will return again in future. At present, this may be a dull, dim feeling, but then they will be prompted by their teachers to ask how this dim feeling or sense of things relates to the rest of their inner life. And as this education progresses, through all kinds of similar questions and formulations, young people will come to experience that this, in quotes, something they dimly sense as living repeatedly on earth destroys their thinking, prevents them thinking, tries to kill off thoughts. And this will be a very important feeling, dawning in them and being developed in people of the East by their education, though in a very natural way, not inculcated. They will acquire a feeling that there is something in them that passes from one life to another, but which also, as earthly human beings, deprives them of thinking, numbs this faculty, and makes it void, kills it off. When I feel this deeper aspect within me, they will say, I cannot think properly. My thinking grows dull. This deeper aspect of my being undermines my thinking. I feel my eternal being within me, but I experience it almost as a murderer of my thoughts. This sense or feeling will be one of many extremely interesting things emerging in Eastern Europe and spreading into the world. Actually, it strikes me that anyone with some knowledge of Eastern European literature and art can discern the beginnings of this already. The works of Dostoevsky herald it in figures who strive to the best of their ability, but as they do so come to feel like an inward murderer, a barrier of their thoughts. This is because the consciousness soul must come to expression there in a very particular form, and is one of the elements of the human soul, which, as I have said before, is most closely bound to the earth. As we advance toward the future, and the soul comes to sense its capacity to feel the reality of recurring lives on earth, this will be an experience different in kind from that of pre-Christian times, in ancient Greece, say, when the sentient soul was experienced in its full vitality. No, gradually instead, the rational or mind soul will also be experienced as something lying further back in us that kills off and deadens thoughts. But education will not end there. These souls will feel themselves to be the inner grave of their own being, and yet a grave that makes space for a revelation of the world of spirit. This feeling will follow from the other, and I would like to characterize it now. Souls will say to themselves, quote, I experience my eternal being, which passes on from one life to the next, as something that deadens my thinking exertions, eradicates my thinking. But in its place, divine thinking streams in and fills the grave of my own thoughts. Close quote. The spirit self will arrive. The consciousness soul enters the grave, and in this way the spirit self appears. I am no longer describing this merely schematically. Here is the consciousness soul, and then the spirit self appears. But I want to give you a real sense of the nature of the human soul as the capital I gradually experiences this transition from the consciousness soul to the spirit self. I want to show how this dawns in the East, giving people there a sense that the eternal on earth, in decline since Greco-Roman times, has developed in a way that destroys ordinary thinking, a thinking that emanates from the human being alone, leaving him empty, but not empty in vain. Into this emptiness, a new spiritual revelation gradually enters, initially in the form of the spirit self expanding in the human soul. Such things do not emerge without significant inner dramas and tragedies. Countless people in the East, particularly, will experience profound inner tragedy and suffering through a sense that their intrinsic being annihilates their thinking. A certain weariness and dullness will come over people as they find that the ideal they hold dear of seeking their true nature does not bring them liberation initially, but instead an inner deadening and weariness. The people of Central Europe exist, in a sense, to bring objectivity to bear on these circumstances, to understand them, and gain orientation in relation to them. They will only fulfill this task if they really attend to what is happening and developing. In doing so, though, they must recollect what I called a, quote, forgotten stream, close quote, of thought and culture in my book titled The Riddle of Man. It really is extremely important for people to understand once more something that has largely been forgotten and once existed as a power to understand the whole world, to encompass the whole world in thought. Who nowadays still recognizes the grandeur of Friedrich Schlegel's view of all human culture, for instance? Great minds such as Schelling, Hegel, and Fichte offered deep insights into the evolution of humanity, yet these are more or less forgotten now. There is much talk of Fichte today, but those who speak most about such thinkers understand them the least. Think, too, how understanding could be enlivened if people really imbued themselves with the way in which Goethe saw the world. Much is necessary if this is to be achieved. We should return to a Goethean view of the world, but still more importantly, we ourselves should state clearly how much we owe to Goethe. The relationship and affinity between our building in Dornach and the mind of Goethe is something I believe that many fail to grasp. It would be important to emphasize this. This view of Western and Eastern culture is something that thinkers in the West and East also express. One just has to understand them properly, interpreting in the right way even what surfaces in political speeches in the West, and seeing how certain instincts that come to the fore are connected with the evolution of the human soul. The instinct for earthly dominion, as this holds sway in Anglo-Americanism, is closely connected with the ideal of becoming a kind of earthly ghost in the future. What announces itself in the East, on the other hand, can be found imbuing every sentence of the remarkable lecture which Rabindranath Tagore gave on, quote, the spirit of Japan, which can now be found in almost every bookshop. What I am speaking about is not found there in so many words, of course, but it pulses through all the sentiments which an Eastern mind such as this, though from the Far East, from a more Oriental point of view, says about developments in Eastern Europe. It would be very important for people of both West and East, for people everywhere in the world, to recognize what the spirit substance of Central Europe contains. Naturally, people first attend to what is apparent outwardly and physically. If an Oriental person wants to find out more about Goethe, and in Asia very important books have been published recently, such as the volume I have mentioned before by Ku Hung Ming, he is very likely to turn to the Goethe Society, whose headquarters are located in the city that was once the center of Goethe's work. And yet this same society cultivates Goethean culture in a very odd and hitherto unknown way. It would have been possible to make Goethe's work available and productive for a life of culture very far-reaching in its scope, and Baroness Sophie has done things of immeasurable worth and maturity for Goetheanism. But then a Goethe society was founded. Who represents it? Is it someone in whom the spirit of Goethe really lives? No. It is very characteristic of our time that this society is directed by a former finance minister. But people sleepwalk through such things, though they shouldn't. People should open their eyes to what is happening in the world. Recently I pointed out that besides the 1.5 billion people on Earth, there are another 540 million human hands, in quotes, in the form of machines developed in recent centuries. This has introduced a major Ahrimanic thrust into humanity's evolution. This Ahrimanic impulse is based on something that has become very necessary, the scientific exploration of our surroundings. We talked about this last time. Over the past 4 centuries, scientific discoveries have necessitated a close study of nature, of laws at work in the natural world and its creatures. Human beings carry this scientific mode of inquiry into all sorts of other fields and disciplines too, for example, into a study of history, where it does not belong. No scientist will be inclined to sing hymns or paeans of praise to nature as an all-embracing unity, which would be of little use to modern civilization. And yet pan-naturalism outlooks of this kind do exist. And I will give you an example of this. An historian called Layard, who was investigating the ancient city of Nineveh, once asked the Qadi of Mosul to describe the character and function of his different servants and the previous history of certain states in the region. This was far too detailed and scientific for the Qadi. He failed to understand why one could be interested in the different characters of his servants or the history of the region, which for him were just, quote, part of the landscape, close quote. He said that such questions originated in, quote, European nonsense, close quote, about studying the natural world, and he replied to the researcher, quote, listen, my son, the only true reality is believing in God. And this truth, believing in God, should restrain you from trying to investigate his deeds. Look up, you see there a star that circles around another. And you see a star with a long tail, which has taken many, many years to arrive here. It will take many, many years to depart from us again. Who would be so foolish as to try to investigate the orbits of this star? The hand that created it will also guide and direct it. Listen, my son. You say that this is not curiosity, but that you have a greater thirst for knowledge than I do. If your knowledge has made you a better man than you once were, you are doubly welcome to me. But do not ask that I should concern myself with such things. I concern myself only with the knowledge that consists in faith in God. I despise all other knowledge. Or let me ask you this. Has this knowledge, which stumbles all over the place, succeeded in giving you a second stomach? Or has it opened your eyes to paradise? Close quote. Thus spake the Qadi of Mosul in his diatribe against natural science. You may smile at this and its seemingly naive outlook. And yet spiritual science continually encounters something similar, although in a different realm. There are a great many, quote, Qadis of Mosul, close quote, in fact, and they keep saying there is no need whatever to concern oneself with any spiritual matter beyond a faith in God. Just as the Qadi of Mosul rejected science, so a great many people today, in fact, key figures in culture especially, reject the science of the spirit. A booklet has just been published, very well-meaning in its way, and yet one finds there this sentence, quote, what is wrong with spiritual science is its effort to know something about the world of spirit, whereas the real meaning of religious life consists in not knowing anything of this world, instead having the trust, the great trust, to believe in something one knows nothing of. Close quote. It is meant to be an excellent quality, therefore, to admit that one knows nothing, but that one still accepts the divine. People have not yet realized, as they should, that this faithful relationship to the world of spirit is really precisely the same as the Qadi of Mosul's view, which amused you, of the physical world of the senses, and knowledge of this world. It is really very important that humanity starts making the transition from knowledge of the natural world to a knowledge of the world of spirit. We need to be clear about this, for on it depends whether we can in future develop a worldview capable of laying the healthy foundations for human society. Our society can have no real basis in studies such as those nowadays termed economics. Economics, as it exists today, consists either of old traditions that serve no further use, or dry straws in the wind. A national economy worthy of the name will only come about when a thinking drawn from the world of spirit is imbued with the power of ideas. The economic orthodoxies taught in schools find their ultimate consequences in the minds of enemies of humanity, such as Lenin and Trotsky. Human powers of real future potential can only emerge in us through a knowledge of worlds of spirit. Today we may need to resort to paradoxes in speaking of the West and the East, as I have done, and yet such paradox encompasses spiritual realities. Unless people can gain insight into these spiritual realities, earthly conditions will increasingly plummet into chaos. Concepts that still had some validity a few years back no longer mean anything. In all areas, there is a need to relearn everything afresh. Religions will only continue to have meaning for people if they encompass real knowledge of the worlds of spirit. To do this, and this relates not only to their content, but to the forms they have gradually assumed, they will need to learn that such forms and traditions no longer really speak to us inwardly, and can only do so by invoking real powers originating in the world of spirit. The, quote, Qadis of Mosul, close quote, though not just from Mosul, of course, but everywhere, must fade from public discourse. I have put this very simply, but I think you can feel that a very great deal more is contained in it. But now, we must consider the following specific question. How is it that transformations undergone by the human soul, occurring from the 12th century onward, and in a broader sense from the 8th and 7th centuries BC up to our own time, have remained so hidden from human awareness? This is because there still resides in human nature, as one of the deepest mysteries in humanity, some quality of another world. We will only come to understand the human being if we succeed a little in fathoming this other world, which seeks to remain hidden. And next time, we will speak further of this. The end of Lecture 17.